This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. I'm Joel Hilliker. America is suffering attacks from weapons of mass distraction. What do you see when you look at the news? It's all about the dangers of COVID, the dangers of people not getting vaccinated, the dangers of white nationalism, the dangers of climate change. Now, we have real threats within the nation, and that includes government overreach and the destruction of our freedoms. We have runaway government spending. We have rising debt and inflation, rising crime, out of control immigration. There are a lot of examples of radicalism and immorality taking over our education and our politics. But you also have real threats from outside the nation, from enemy nations, threats that are increasing all around us. There are nations that see that America is very sick and is dying, and they see this as an opportunity. The wolves are circling. Dangerous threats are rising in the world, and Americans are ignoring them because we're so concerned with non-issues. We're caught up in trivialities, and really, we're fighting each other rather than facing outside enemies together. Now, what are the consequences of this trend? We're going to talk about this in our first segment. In our second segment, we'll look at a related problem, and that is video game addiction. The numbers of people playing video games for hours upon hours and really allowing real life to pass them by is just stunning. This is a true epidemic. I think you can argue the effects are a lot worse than the physical problems associated with contracting COVID-19. Which we take very, very, very seriously. But we're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about this. And then an exciting archaeological discovery, a small bulla unearthed in Jerusalem that verifies the identity of another important biblical personality, this of the chief steward of King Hezekiah, Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. Now, why is this important? We're going to talk to the host of the Watch Jerusalem podcast, Brent Noctegal, about this subject. And at the end of the show, we'll have a last word about the importance of every small step you take. But let's start by talking about America being distracted from facing its enemies. I want to read a segment from the book Love Letter to America by Thomas Schumann, and that's the pen name for a man who defected from Soviet Russia. He was a former KGB operative named Yuri Bezmenov. In 1984, Bezmenov came to the United States and he wrote this book, Love Letter to America, and he really did love America, and he had a very unique perspective, somebody who knew how communists were working to destroy this country. So this book, it's a small book, and it's a warning to Americans about the tactics that the Soviets are using to undermine their number one enemy, the United States of America. This book exposes their plan. And essentially, the plan is convince people who live in the world's freest, most just, most affluent, racially integrated country with the greatest opportunity for people of all races and types and cultures to believe the opposite. And the method that they use is ideological subversion. Bezmenov says this is the process of changing the perception of reality in the minds of millions of people. Now, this is very much like the prophecy that you read in Isaiah 5, verses 20 and 21, which says that there would come a point when people would call evil good and good evil, and they would put darkness for light and light for darkness. This is really the effects of the kind of ideological subversion that Bezmenov is describing here. This is what he says in this book. The main principle of ideological subversion is turning a stronger force against itself. Just like in the Japanese martial arts, you don't stop the blow of a heavier, more powerful enemy with an equally forceful blow. You may simply hurt your hand. Instead, you catch the striking fist with your hand and pull the enemy in the direction of his own blow until he crashes into a wall or any other heavy object in his way. Now, America is a very strong adversary, and the Soviets realized very early on that the best way to defeat us was using that kind of judo move, that it's using our own forces against ourselves rather than trying to confront them directly. And they used a lot of tactics to do that. And Bezmenov likened this to trying to attack a building that has explosive materials in it. He says, to destroy this house, the enemy does not have to intrude physically into it. It is enough to start a fire next door and wait till the wind blows in the right direction. Meanwhile, the enemy may, quote, throw in some great ideas for the owners to argue about in order to take their attention off the actual fire. Environmental protection, gay liberation or emancipation of house pets are the types of non-critical arguments that divert America's attention from the real danger. Smart people would notice the fire and remove the inflammable objects and materials before the house catches the fire. Useful idiots will keep arguing about whether it is constitutional or not to pay firefighters, or the equality of husband and wife in domestic chores, who should remove the combustibles, until the actual explosion blows their enfeebled brains all over the neighborhood. This is the warning from this KGB defector. He wrote that in 1984. So here we are, 37 years down the road, more than a whole generation. And our preoccupation with what he called these non-critical arguments has become all-consuming. Americans are turning all of our focus on each other over a whole range of non-issues. If it's not racism and white nationalism, then it's the supposed genocide that police are committing against people of color, or it's toxic masculinity, or it's carbon emissions, it's Confederate statues, it's the oppression of LGBTQ plus people, or misgendering a man who says he's a woman. It's whether you wear a mask in public. It's whether you'll comply with vaccination mandates. We're tearing each other up over these non-issues, non-critical arguments. America has enemies. Apparently, most Americans are unconcerned about this, but there are foreign nations that are very happy to see America in decline and would love to see America fall. And they're overjoyed to see us ripping each other to shreds over all of these issues that we believe are the most dangerous threats plaguing our nation. But you look around and survey what else is happening in the world right now, and you see all kinds of serious problems that Americans really should be paying attention to. Have you been watching Afghanistan? On July 8th, President Biden announced an unconditional withdrawal from Afghanistan by the end of August. So this is what he said.
We did not go to Afghanistan to nation build. And it's the right and the responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide their future and how they want to run their country.
Well, that sounds fine. But what's happening is that the Taliban is taking over. Reuters reports that six Afghan provincial capitals have fallen to the Taliban just since last Friday. This is Axios. It says the string of swift Taliban successes in the final weeks of the U.S. withdrawal has dented hopes that the Afghan military and allied militias will be able to fend off the insurgency. It says 229 Afghan districts are now under Taliban control. That's compared to only 66 that are controlled by the Afghan government and then 112 more that are contested. That's according to Long War Journal. Most of the initial gains were in the countryside, but the Taliban is now targeting major cities. Now, this is moving very fast. It was just July 16th that the Taliban and the government controlled roughly an equal number of districts. But the Taliban is making very, very rapid gains. And Axios says the Taliban is also targeting senior officials for assassination. Dawa Khan Menipal, who ran the government's media department, was killed on Friday shortly after a failed assassination attempt on Afghanistan's defense minister. Now, this is something that the Trumpet has been saying, our editor-in-chief has been saying, from the very beginning, when we started this war back in 2001, that America was never going to win this war. It's been a cursed war from the beginning. And what happens now when that territory goes right back to the people that America has been trying to wrest it from now for all this time? Well, there's an article in Al Monitor that says how armed groups across the Middle East could get a boost from the Taliban taking control of Afghanistan. It says a dizzying array of foreign armed troops have at some point in recent months allegedly collaborated with the Taliban or fought under their flag in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, under the Taliban regime in the late 1990s, served as a training ground for some of those who would later join the Islamic State and for others who would train them in propaganda and the use of explosives. The United States went into Afghanistan specifically to break up this type of activity. And now we're turning it back over to them and acting like, well, we did our job there. That's what Joe Biden says. He says that we went in there to deal with the terrorists who committed 9/11 and to render justice to Osama bin Laden. So he's not making making any victory parades, but he's basically saying mission accomplished. And that territory is going right back to the very people that we were trying to route from that area. So we're leaving Afghanistan. America is leaving Afghanistan. July 22nd, the U.S. and Iraq agreed to withdraw all U.S. combat forces from Iraq by the end of this year. Now, this is following on from President Trump initiating the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Somalia earlier this year, and then President Biden decided in January to no longer support Saudi Arabia's war against the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen. So there's pullbacks, drawdowns all across the region. You put all of this together from Pakistan all the way down to the Horn of Africa, the United States is retreating. And radical Islamist forces, most notably led by Iran, are stepping in and filling that vacuum. What are we seeing? You see the increased Iranian attacks against commercial vessels in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. We talked about that last week on this program. You see the growing power of Iranian-aligned politicians for military forces in Iraq. You see the Taliban taking over all of that territory in Afghanistan. You see al-Shabaab reasserting itself in Somalia and beyond that. The evidence is all around that when the United States pulls back, then chaos reigns in its absence. And of course, all of this is having an interesting effect on Europe. When the United States withdraws from the Middle East, it's forcing Europe to take more action because of the problems that this is creating, which are much closer to Europe than they are to the United States. The drawdown in Afghanistan is threatening another refugee crisis. North Africa is falling apart as American forces withdraw, and they can't afford a refugee crisis. So Europe is trying to increase its presence in these areas to clean up the mess that the United States is leaving behind. Look at what is happening in Europe. Just this past May, you had this Nord Stream 2 pipeline that was greenlighted by the Biden administration. He lifted the Trump-era sanctions on this pipeline. This is a major energy project between Germany and Russia that's just about completed. And this strongly empowers both of these nations. We've talked a lot about this on this program because it's very concerning how these nations will use the leverage that this pipeline gives them. Germany will have its power increased because after they receive Russia's gas, the Germans, usually they ship a lot of that onto France and the Netherlands and other nations. But if they had any reason to cut off a certain nation from these shipments, it would be very well positioned to do that with this pipeline. But it will significantly boost Russia's leverage over Ukraine and other former Soviet nations. These are nations that Vladimir Putin really wants to bring more firmly under his control. In the past, he's applied pressure on these nations by cutting off shipments through older pipelines that delivered Russian gas directly into these countries. But the problem was that these pipelines were also the way that Russia delivered gas into Western Europe. So if Russia decided to cut off one of these former Soviet nations, it would also cut off downstream countries like Germany. So now with this pipeline coming on board, Russia will be able to cut off those gas shipments to former Soviet nations without cutting off Germany. So if it wants to, if it wants to weaponize its energy as it has done often in the past, then it's going to have a very sharp and precise blade on that weapon. And we saw this immediately, as we talked about last Friday, Vladimir Putin commenting about Ukraine being part of Russia. This is from the Asia Times. A new law in Ukraine protecting the rights of minorities had the Russian president riled up enough to suggest that Ukraine's sovereignty is subject to a Russian veto. Now, this law was about Ukraine protecting the legal and cultural rights of three minorities that reside in Crimea. And the Asia Times says Moscow annexed Crimea in 2014. In Putin's eyes, that makes them Russian citizens. After its approval by the Ukrainian legislature, Putin not only protested the law, but delivered a 5,000-word written manifesto in which he asserted Ukraine exists as a state due only to Russian tolerance. He said there is no such thing as a separate Ukrainian people. They are one with the Russians. The state of Ukraine is an artificial creation, a fluke of history that should be grateful to Russia for allowing it to exist. That's the way Vladimir Putin thinks about Ukraine, this nation that really has tried very hard to ingratiate itself with Europe. And there are a whole lot of Ukrainians that see themselves as far more European than they do Russian. Well, Vladimir Putin disagrees strongly with that. And Germany and Russia are essentially being allowed to divide Europe up between them. And that's largely because America isn't interested. America is turning its back. America is focused on changing the name of its sports teams. And while that's happening, Putin is maintaining a steady onslaught of cyber attacks against some of the U.S.'s most sensitive organizations. He's making steady improvements to Russia's nuclear arsenal. 90% of the warheads in Russia and the intercontinental ballistic missiles, strategic aircraft, and submarines in the nuclear program are now modernized. And Putin demonstrated in July, last month, that Russian fighter jets now carry the nation's Kinzhal hypersonic missiles, which are unstoppable even by the U.S.'s most advanced defense systems. Look over at China. President Xi Jinping has been increasing the nation's military power, especially its nuclear capability. We learned last month, satellite imagery showed that they're building 230 new nuclear missile silos across the country. And once construction on these silos is complete, China is going to have some 250 nuclear ICBM silos in operation, more than 12 times its current number. The number of nuclear warheads on Chinese ICBMs could potentially increase to somewhere between 415 and 875, depending on which type of missiles are loaded into these silos. Two analysts said this is the most significant expansion of the Chinese nuclear arsenal ever. Now, this is happening at the same time that the Chinese are advancing and taking over the South China Sea. They're developing weaponry intended to disable or destroy U.S. satellites, which are vital to the operation of America's military. China has continued its cyber attacks against U.S. companies and universities and government bureaus. They're stealing untold terabytes of America's most sensitive trade secrets. In July, the U.S. Justice Department said that Chinese campaigns target industries ranging from education to biopharmaceuticals to aviation, maritime transportation, and defense. And last month, China also maneuvered to help the Communist Party, Cuba, suppress the largest protests against it in a decade. So by helping the Cuban regime to stay afloat, Xi Jinping deepened China's influence just 90 miles away from the United States and right alongside some of America's most important shipping lanes. These nations are preparing for war. And what is America doing? We're debating gender pronouns. We're talking about how much we should pay in reparations for slavery. We're talking about how to replace police with social workers. We are being attacked by weapons of mass distraction, and it is self-inflicted. Read Hosea 13 and verse 9, where God says, "O Israel," and he's talking to modern America, the modern descendants of ancient Israel. He says, "O Israel, you have destroyed yourself." God loves America. He loves America, and he mourns to see what we are doing to ourselves. "You have destroyed yourself," he says. And just look at what is happening. Look at what we are doing to ourselves. God also says in Ezekiel 33 and verse 11, "Say to them, as I live, says the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn you from your evil ways, for why will you die, O house of Israel?" God is truly emotional when he sees what America is doing to itself and just how much we are being distracted away from the things that we really should be concerned about, looking at what is happening in this world and just recognizing how dangerous this world really is and how serious our enemies are. God continues in Hosea 13. He says, "But in me is your help. I will be your king." It's just a beautiful promise. And then it's followed by this piercing question: "Where is any other that may save you in all your cities?" Just look at the reality of what is happening, and you have to ask, how could anyone but God save us? Where is there any man to solve these problems? God is reaching out, and he would help us. He would solve our problems. He would unite us. He would be our king if only we would embrace his law and submit to his rule. God loves America, and he wants to prevent our destruction if he can. But he's only going to do so if we allow him to.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Video games are extremely popular, probably far more than you think. And this comes with some serious problems, as we will now learn in this report from Abraham Blondeau.
The World Health Organization estimates that every year, 350,000 people around the world die from opioid use. 30% of those deaths are from overdose. In 2019, 62 million people worldwide used some kind of opioid. That is a real epidemic. However, there is an even more prolific epidemic going on inside of millions of people's homes, and that is the video game opioid epidemic. On August 2nd, Chinese state media said online gaming was, quote, spiritual opium that has grown into an industry worth hundreds of billions. No industry, no sport, can be allowed to develop in a way that will destroy a generation, end quote. Even Chinese state media can see the massively destructive nature of the modern video game culture. It is derailing the lives of millions of people. Video games have been engineered to act like a drug to the brain, making people search for the next high. This spiritual opium is dangerous to physical, mental, and spiritual health, and even national security. According to Statista, there were 2.7 billion gamers worldwide in 2020. China leads the way with 743 million gamers. The United States has 277 million gamers, with the average spending 7 to 12 hours each week playing games. The Telegraph's Annabelle Heseltine wrote that in 2018, the WHO classified gaming disorder as an illness, with, by their conservative estimate, some 86 million victims. Gaming disorder is a pattern of gaming behavior, digital gaming or video gaming, characterized by impaired control over gaming, increasing priority given to gaming over other activities, to the extent that gaming takes precedence over other interests and daily activities, and continuation or escalation of gaming despite the occurrence of negative consequences. This is describing an addiction, when someone's behavior becomes subservient to satisfying the desire for that activity. It is an addiction. Video game developers are creating virtual drugs and targeting children, all to make a profit. Heseltine outlines dangers video games pose to school-aged children, showing that MRI scans have found that the part of the brain which controls compulsive behavior and decision-making tend to be less developed in teenagers who game for more than 10 hours a day. Additionally, a survey by the charity Childwise showed that school-aged children spend an average of 6 hours a day in front of screens, while another report showed that teenagers spend closer to 10 hours a day, with 43% having internet access in their bedrooms. Children are being left unmonitored and unrestrained in their consumption of video games. School-aged children have free access to the internet behind a closed bedroom door, open access to any manner of media on the internet. This leaves them vulnerable to strangers online via video game communities, forums, and chat rooms, where kids are encouraged to run up bills on their parents' credit cards. There is also the increasing problem of pedophiles and sexual predators using video game platforms to target children. In 2019, the New York Times warned that video games and online chats are hunting grounds for perverts. In one specific example, a parent was horrified when she discovered her 13-year-old son was being exposed to child bestiality videos on his Discord server, which is a chat room you can use while online gaming. In this case, the 13-year-old was only allowed to play Minecraft and Fortnite in a room where he was monitored by his parents constantly. None of that stopped this teenager from being exposed to unspeakable filth. All of this has gotten much worse since the coronavirus lockdowns have isolated children at home. Many parents were pressured to allow kids unrestricted access to video games and the internet so their kids could have a social life. Novelist Abby Silver wrote, quote, "The problem is that although a significant bank of research links high levels of online gaming with depression, social anxiety, suicidal tendencies, and difficulties in holding down relationships, they are not joined up and rarely supported by public health initiatives," end quote. Heseltine outlined 5 ways video games affect physical health. Those are short-sightedness, gamer's thumb, less sleep, increased obesity, and painful posture. Another side effect from video game addiction is that young people in the prime of their life are choosing to stay home and play video games instead of working. In the first quarter of 2021, the U.S. had 9 million open jobs with 10 million unemployed. No one is urgent to get a job. Could video game addiction have something to do with it? During the COVID pandemic, I was a manager at a distribution warehouse, and I personally saw this all the time. Young people would leave work early or decide to take multiple days off so they could go home and play video games. Even when they would work a 10-hour shift, they told me they would go home, play video games for a few hours, and then end up only getting a couple hours of sleep. When the PlayStation 5 was released, we had to scramble and call emergency overtime because so many people were no-shows, all because they wanted to get their new console. Despite the mountain of evidence showing how detrimental video games are to society, the industry has no intention of slowing down. In 2020, the industry had a total revenue of $175 billion, an increase of 20%. These billions of dollars are not going to American and Japanese companies, but they are actually flowing into China. While the Chinese state media was correct in identifying video games as dangerous, the statement was actually propaganda doublespeak. While condemning the industry, China is actually the largest consumer and producer of video games in the world. This is partially due to its large population, but it is also a deliberate strategy to create a powerful propaganda tool. The American Conservative reported that after decades of American and Japanese dominance, Chinese dominance is on the rise. A lot of Chinese companies are acquiring different video game developers, and that's reason to believe that they'll have quite a bit of influence on video games in the next few years. China is actually planning on using video games to inject propaganda into the minds of Westerners. Abhishek Prakash, co-founder of the Center for Innovating the Future, said, quote, "China has several ways it can take its ideals to the world through games and build a new kind of global power," end quote. Since China has the largest gaming market, more and more developers want to operate in China, but that comes with a price. To operate in China, they must partner with a local Chinese company, which has say in the content of the games. The Chinese firm Tencent, which has strong ties to the Chinese government, bought Riot Games for over $400 million in 2015. Riot Games made one of the biggest video games of all time, League of Legends. Tencent has also invested and bought out some of the largest developers in the world, including Activision Blizzard and Epic Games, who makes Fortnite, which is the biggest video game in the world. It has even bought out Discord, the communications platform. Not only can China control the content and narratives in the games, subtly injecting propaganda into the minds of billions, but they also have access to the personal data of millions of Americans. This is a major national security threat. The Wall Street Journal reported on this threat, writing, quote, "China is already using games to spread its soft power and collect data on U.S. citizens, as the current administration has highlighted. Beijing's access to millions of gamers' computers give its spies an unrivaled opportunity to use games to conduct intelligence operations," end quote. This is leaving Americans completely helpless to be exploited by the Chinese state. The Wall Street Journal article goes on to explain that the data harvested from games can be exploited far more easily than other Chinese-based companies like TikTok, and in most cases, gamers have to supply their real name, credit card information, dates of birth and locations, and even create voice samples. All this information is likely being held on Chinese data servers and can be easily accessed by the Chinese state. It only takes 10 minutes of audio to create a voice deepfake that might fool your friends and family. And when this information is cross-referenced with other data hacks that the Chinese have already done, this gives them the ability to actually pinpoint government officials' locations every time they play a video game. Since all modern video games have anti-cheating software that runs undetected on your computer, the Chinese government can actually use that software to access files on the host computer. 3/4 of Americans play video games and could have all their personal data stored on Chinese databases. This virtual opioid is not only destroying our society, it is even undermining our national security. However, the greatest danger is actually to our spiritual health. Spiritual opium is an apt description. Video games have become an idol to millions of people. They are consuming people's minds so much they cannot focus on anything else. It is their God, to whom they give the prime of their energy, time, and effort. The real author of this epidemic is not the greedy developers or the communist Chinese. but the spiritual adversary of all of mankind, Satan the devil. He wants our minds to be consumed by idols and by evil. He wants to destroy each person's incredible human potential. Perhaps you don't think of a physical thing like video games as an idol, but in reality, we all have idols. Herbert W. Armstrong explained this beautifully in his autobiography. Quote, "Whoever you are, you have or have had an idol. You have had another God before the true, living, almighty God. It might be your hobby or your habitual pastime. It might be your husband or wife or child or children. It might be your job. It might be your own vanity or the lipstick you paint on or your business or profession. Very often, it is the opinion of your friends, your family, your group of social or business contacts." End quote. Video games can be an idol. It can actually separate you from God, which is the worst possible consequence for anyone. The evidence shows how video game addiction leads to all sorts of other societal and family issues. It is literally unraveling families and filling young minds with a fantasy they worship, instead of seeking to have a relationship with God. How can video game addiction be fixed? Many psychologists and therapists try to help millions of people a year overcome this addiction, but Mr. Armstrong provided the answer. Quote, "But whatever it is, the idol must first be crushed, smashed. It must be literally torn out of your mind, even though it hurts more than having all your teeth pulled out, and perhaps a jawbone too. I don't believe that many people experience this painlessly. I don't know of any anesthetic that will render it pleasurable. Usually it seems like something more excruciating than the agony of death by the cruelest torture." End quote. Mr. Armstrong learned from harsh experience that idols have to be smashed and completely removed. Only then can an addiction, a problem, an idol be conquered. It might be the most painful thing you do, but it can lead to fantastic, abundant living. This is how we can overcome and grow individually and as a nation. But this change must be accompanied by a change in how parents work with their children. The video game epidemic is exposing the failure of parenting in our Western world. Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote, quote, "The designers of these programs aren't the only ones to blame. The parents of tech-addicted children should have put restrictions on them to prevent them from becoming addicted in the first place. Whenever I read stories of children playing video games until 4 in the morning, I wonder, why aren't the parents making them go to bed? Children want no limits. Even parents believe that limits are generally bad, but children without limits are miserable." End quote. How many children, like the 13-year-old boy we cited earlier, want help and desperately need protection, but are left to the mercy of this merciless industry? Parents who actually restrain their children protect not only their kids, but also protect their country. There is so much more to life than living in video game fantasies and following the trends of society. God has built an incredible human potential planned for each and every person. It does take tough decisions, but it leads to real abundant life, more rewarding and adventurous than any video game could ever be. To learn about your potential, please read The Incredible Human Potential by Herbert W. Armstrong.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Archaeology in Israel is continually unearthing evidence of the veracity of the Bible. We have news of a discovery that was made a few years ago, but it received very little attention. But we've learned about it, and it's quite important to us at The Trumpet and our sister website, Watch Jerusalem. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem the host of the Watch Jerusalem podcast, Brent Nachtigall. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So this discovery verifies the identity of an important biblical personality. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a seal impression that belongs to somebody that's mentioned in the Bible, a person from 2,800 years ago that features really heavily in the story of King Hezekiah, the prophet Isaiah, and the Assyrian Empire Emperor Sennacherib's assault on Judah. And in terms of a an epic biblical event that really, like, the history's page turned on. It was this, as far as Judah goes, because at the time you had the Assyrian Empire that was taking over the known world. They'd already taken the northern kingdom into captivity, and Judah was just left, and they had really taken over most of the fenced, if not all of the fenced cities, the walled cities of Judah. And then they came to Jerusalem, and one of the main figures that's there talking with Isaiah the prophet and King Hezekiah about what to do about this is this man, Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. And this is the seal impression. The seal impression belonging to this man was found back in 2014, but released to the public in 2019. However, it, as you mentioned, it did not receive much discussion at all in the press. There wasn't one popular article written about it in the press. It was buried in a scholarly article that was published in an archaeological journal. And it seems like it should receive far more attention, because here we have another biblical figure from this really important time in history that is coming to life for us.
Well, yeah, you could see how discoveries related to King David, King Solomon, some of the more prominent figures in the Bible would get a lot more press. Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, not a household name in most households, but for us, we're quite familiar with this, not only because of the connection to the history that you're mentioning, but for other reasons as well that we can get into. But talk about the bullet itself and what is depicted on it, why it's actually quite pristine and quite beautiful.
Yeah, it is. So let's talk about, as you said, the seal impression itself, which is basically the signature or a seal that is given to seal a document with correspondence from the owner, basically. And so this was found in Lachish, which is the second most important city in Judah at the time, 2,700 years ago. And one of these seal impressions was actually found in the field with somebody's eyeballs. It was found inside a little juglet that was preserved in the destruction of Lachish. So when Sennacherib comes, he destroys the city. Stuff is remaining in the destruction, in the burn layer. This juglet is inside the burn layer. Inside the juglet is one of these seal impressions. Now, an identical one was found when the earth around that juglet was wet sifted. So the dirt was sifted and then sprayed with water, and then they found an identical one coming from the same original seal. And the seal impression itself does not say Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. We wish it did, because then there might be less confusion. However, it does say Eliakim Yehozara. Yehozara is a name that is not mentioned in the biblical text, not once, but the son of is implied there, Eliakim, son of Yehozara. However, in 1974, there was another seal impression that came up on the Antiquities Market that scholars have deemed it to be authentic, although we don't know exactly how or what excavation site it came out of. And this seal impression is very important because it makes the connection back to Hilkiah, who the Bible says Eliakim is the son of Hilkiah, when he is somebody, an important figure in Hezekiah's court. But what is also important about this other bulla that was from the Antiquities Market, it says belonging to Yehozara, son of Hilkiah, a servant of Hezekiah. And so here you have somebody that, going back to 1974, 75, with this impression, everybody was like, hey, this is the brother. This is the brother of the famous Eliakim, because they have the same father, Hilkiah, and they're both in the court of Hezekiah. So that was the theory regarding that seal impression until this one was discovered, where it says Eliakim, son of Yehozara, which then implies that it can't be Eliakim, brother, with a brother's name mentioned on the same seal impression. We don't have evidence of that anywhere. And so it's his father is Yehozara. And so what we have in the Bible, the scholars would say, is that a generation has been skipped. Really, it should mean that there was Eliakim, son of Yehozara, who's not mentioned in the Bible, son of Hilkiah. And the Bible does this very often. where if there is a more famous grandfather, he is just mentioned as the son of, or he has his grandchildren can be mentioned as his sons. And so these scholars that wrote up this, Yossi Garfinkel was one of them, he excavated Lachish, another couple of American archaeologists were a part of it. They have no doubt in their minds, well, I'd say very little doubt in their minds, that this belongs to the Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, mentioned in the Bible.
So the timing of this announcement is very interesting, and I'm just reminded of the From the Editor piece in our new Trumpet print edition. Our editor-in-chief wrote an article, A Tiny Artifact Proclaims a Powerfully Encouraging Message, and he's talking about this bulla that's associated with King Jeroboam. And we have this terrific article in there from you, Brent, and from Brad McDonald, the managing editor of thetrumpet.com, explaining the role historically of King Jeroboam and how this really relates to our day today. These are ancient personalities. This is ancient history. But as is the case with so much of the Bible, there are prophetic implications with some of that history. There are times where history becomes prophecy, and there are types anciently that relate to modern day personalities. That article that you all put together, and that article from our editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, explains the connection with King Jeroboam. So the fact that this artifact that was discovered some time ago, but suddenly it's come into prominence, it's quite encouraging. He calls it a powerfully encouraging message that is coming from this little artifact that was discovered. We kind of have a similar story with this Eliakim bulla. Maybe you can just explain the significance of this for us.
Right. So we have, and if you've been following and read our material a lot, if you've read the Isaiah booklet, the Key of David booklet, the New Throne of David booklet, you'll see Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, mentioned a lot in those texts. And this was relating specifically from a passage of scripture in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 22. And in that chapter, which is actually something that happens in historically far before Hezekiah and Sennacherib and that ordeal, you have Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, mentioned in the context of receiving his office of holding the key to the house of David. And if you're looking at this in the physical type, this would be the key to the palace or the royal affairs of King Hezekiah. He was of the line of David. And of course, Mr. Fleury has written at length since 2001, I believe it might have been, something like that, and possibly even before, that he feels like that his office definitely is a type of Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. And so this is a name that I would say 99.9% of people are reading this article about biblical Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, been discovered, and they would be like, who is that?
Right.
But anyone that's been a longtime follower of thetrumpet.com would realize this is a very important figure, prophetically, even more important than the role that this man fulfilled anciently. And again, this is just another sign, as with the Jeroboam seal impression, that God is showing that these types are true. These types are accurate. We do have a modern day type of Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, on the scene today as well.
Well, we've been talking with the Trumpet's Jerusalem correspondent and the host of the Watch Jerusalem podcast, Brent Noctegal, about the Eliakim bulla discovered in Jerusalem back in 2014, announced in 2019. He's given a podcast about this subject that you can find at Watch Jerusalem. It's there on the front page, and also written an article about this. We'll link to both of those in the show notes for the program today, but go visit watchjerusalem.co.il, and you can find those there, as well as many other articles and podcasts about all kinds of subjects. If you're interested in these subjects, Watch Jerusalem is the place to go for information about Jerusalem archaeology and history and current events and news regarding Israeli politics and biblical prophecy. If you're interested in these, you can even subscribe to their free email briefs by visiting that website, watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks so much, Brent. It's great to have you on.
No problem. Thanks for the plug.
It's time for today's last word.
Life is a journey of millions of small steps. It's a lot of tiny choices that lead to either good or ill. But the steps are so small and so many that usually we're careless about the step we're taking. It's no big deal, just one little decision, just one step. But how life-changing a single step can be. Every step points in a direction. One step leads to more steps. It leads away from other steps. It can put you on a different path. One step can determine failure or success. It can mean life or death. Both sin and righteousness start with one step. According to the Bible, Lucifer's attempt to dethrone God started with one step. His sin began when he momentarily harbored an attitude of self-love, and then he allowed vanity to lead to self-righteousness, to a sense of entitlement, to resentment, to bitterness, to hostility, step by step down a dark path. Then he spread his attitude. He persuaded and seduced one angel here, two there. Discussion begat dissension, which bred insubordination, which became defiance, which burst into mutiny, revolt, and warfare. This sequence of steps turned the light bringer into the adversary, and it turned millions of brilliant, fiery angels into demons. As with Lucifer, so with us. Sin always starts in the mind. We conceive it, we mull it, it grows, and it bursts into a sinful act, which leads to death. A terrible bad habit starts with one decision to take the easy route. Debt and bankruptcy trace back to the first ill-advised purchase. A broken friendship begins with a single hurtful comment. A bad marriage stems from one unhealthy secret kept from a spouse. That first small step in the direction of sin is always easy to justify. You want to do something that you know you shouldn't. You think that going just part way won't do any harm. But the reality is, every step down that path leads to more steps into sin. That's why God considers that first step already committing the act spiritually, according to the spirit or intent of the law. When we take that first step, in God's eyes, we're already guilty. He recognizes where that first small step leads. That's why he commands in 1 Corinthians 6 that we flee fornication rather than flirt with it. Take steps in the opposite direction rather than getting close to it. The writer of Psalm 119 wrote that God's word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. God's way of life is a narrow path, and we need that light to guide us and to keep us on the path. If you take a step or two off that path, you're in the dark. And if you don't get back on quickly, well, that lamp can move on. It's important when we recognize that we've taken a misstep to repent immediately and get back on that lighted path right away. The good things we want in life also come step at a time. Just as small steps can take you off the path, small steps also carry you forward to your goal. The Israelites made it from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land one step at a time. The potential that God has given to human beings is tremendous. The calling of a Christian is awesome, almost too awesome to comprehend, but we fulfill that calling through small daily steps. Prayer, study, work, time management, taking care of our body, our mind, our family, our relationships, our possessions. However overwhelming any given objective may seem, recognize the power in using right now to take one step toward that objective. Savings in the bank can start with a dollar. A healthy diet can start with one resisted temptation. A close friendship can start with a single compliment. Force yourself to do the first small thing and you've started moving in the right direction. God tells us to be attentive to our every step in Proverbs 4, verses 25 through 27. It says, "Let your eyes look right on, and let your eyelids look straight before you. Ponder the path of your feet, and let all your ways be established. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove your foot from evil." So, whatever your next step, recognize the power of that simple, everyday choice you're about to make. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Abraham Blondeau and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from G.K. Chesterton. "An adventure is only an inconvenience rightly considered." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.